Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hey, it's Anna. I want to let you know that this episode includes a description of a rape. It comes up at the start of the second half, if you want to skip.
I don't think you can be practicing self-love and being angry at everybody else. I just don't think you can do it. I don't think you can be like, oh my God, and I'm going to go and meditate, but I hate this motherfucker and fuck you and I hate you and you and you and I'm not forgiving. No. So this is what I'm saying, that I had to have a moment where everything would have been crumbling down except for key people in my life who said, you know, these people love you, right? So what are you going to do?
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. For more than 25 years, journalist Maria Hinojosa has hosted the public radio show Latino USA. She's also been a correspondent for NPR, PBS, and CNN, and is the CEO of her own production company.
In order to survive the world that I've been playing in, the world of media, you have to have a huge fucking ego. There ain't no other way to do it.
In most newsrooms where she's worked, Maria was the first or only Latina. And she writes in a new memoir called Once I Was You. She's often felt underestimated and undermined by her white colleagues.
And I talk about this a lot, by the way, to my students, most of whom are of color, most of whom are first generation, is that as Latinos and Latinas, and as people of color in general, we have to walk. And I strut for them. I get in the front of the class. Usually I'm wearing my 6-inch heels or something like that. So strutting is easy. And I'm strutting. And I'm like, you are walking in a space like this. Your shoulders are back. You know everything about everybody. You are the shit. We have to fluff up our own peacock feathers as we walk into any space and believe like we are the most incredible people, because we have to.
But when we talked, Maria admitted that all these decades of having to push and puff herself up have taken a toll.
You know, my marriage almost broke up because of my ego. And the ego, of course, stems from insecurity. It's all insecurity. And my trusty companion is the imposter syndrome that's just right there on my shoulder.
Maria knew she wanted to be a journalist since she was a teenager growing up in Chicago. She came to New York in 1979 for college and hosted a late-night radio show, playing Latin American protest music and interviewing activists and throwing some legendary New York City dance parties.
So there'd be like 300 people with a DJ, no air conditioning, completely sweating it up, and we'd dance until 4 o'clock in the morning. And then depending on whether or not we had money, we'd get on the subway, and the subway was completely graffitied up. Again, no air conditioning. And we'd be rocking on the subways at 4 o'clock in the morning.
I want to go back to when you first arrived in New York City. And you had grown up in a Mexican family in Chicago. You were the youngest of your siblings. You arrive in New York City. When you think about the community that you built, what did it look like and how did you find them?
Thank you for taking me back to this. Ugh, I love this part of my life. Mm. I swear it was so much fun. It was so much fun. Oh my God, it was so much fun. It was New York City, early 1980s. By the way, there were no Mexicans in New York. Couldn't find tortillas anywhere. Nowhere. Couldn't find...
In New York City?
Nowhere in New York City could you find tortillas. Nowhere. Nowhere. Had to start having them sent to me in a box from Chicago. Uh-huh. So you know what it felt like? It felt like I would walk out and I'd be like, Oyeme, soy mexicana. And people would be like, ¿Y qué? You're Mexican and so what? And what that allowed me to do, and for some Mexicans this is controversial, but for me it allowed me to walk away from my Mexican nationalism. Hmm. Because I think nationalism in any way, shape, or form is, well, hello, we're living through it. And so I was glad to be able to walk away from my Mexican nationalism, my Mexican-centric experience in Chicago and just be like, bro, wait, yo soy Latinoamericana. I'm Latin American, yo. I got my Argentinian people over here. I got my Salvadorans. I'm eating pupusas. I'm dancing salsa. Celia Cruz is now a part of my life. You know, everything exploded for me, and I felt like I was part of a continent.
I love that. I'm part of a continent. Is that something you actually said out loud?
Like the Claro.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Also, because this was the 1980s. In Latin America, and we were very conscious about a unified Latin America. This was a time of a lot of activism, and I was, to be clear, among Latinos and Latinas, this is an interesting and necessary conversation. But there were people who were like, Oyeme María, why do you identify as a Latina? You're Mexican. I'm like, Latina is all of us. Yeah, but you know, you're not Puerto Rican. I'm like, no, I'm not. And so I always, again, open up the conversation as like, can we see our humanity in each other? Mm-hmm. And that was the best experience in New York, was just like, oh my God. And then there were like this whole bohemian thing that was going on. There were artists everywhere.
One of those artists was Herman Perez, who would eventually become Maria's husband. She met him a few years after graduating from college.
He's like, you got to come and see my artwork. And I'm like, oh boy. And so I went to his house and I saw his paintings. And I kind of, that's it. Like, I was like, you painted this? And it was Taino Indians in a areirto, in a moon dance that he had captured with all the colors and the palm trees growing out of their heads. And I was like, and then... It could have been a one-night stand, but he was like, hey, I'm just letting you know, I'm not playing. Mm. I'm looking to form a clan. And I was like, a clan? A clan? What are you, a bear? And he was like, I want my family to be the most important thing in my life. Mm. I want to protect my family, and I want a family that... we are going to understand that we have to protect and take care of each other. That's what I want to do.
Maria and Herman married in 1991 and started their family while Maria was also building her career as a journalist. Maria was the primary breadwinner, first as a reporter at NPR, then at CNN starting in 1997. But balancing work and her time with her husband and their two kids wasn't easy.
Doing live television is a drug. It becomes an addiction. Mm-hmm. It becomes an addiction like an adrenaline addiction. But it can also, you know, it can ruin your life. So coming home from work could look like, shit, I was just gone for 3 days reporting on the beheading of a man in Iraq. And I was at his parents' home doing live shots 18 hours a day. Huh. And now I'm walking home. And I'm walking into my house, and I have to basically stand at my front door. I learned this from a from a woman named Mariana who had HIV and then AIDS. And she would say, when I come home, she was from the Bronx, Puerto Rican. And she, when I come home, AIDS stays outside the door. Hmm. AIDS do not come inside the door with me. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, I stand outside the door. Y me hago la limpia. Me limpio. I clean myself. I cleanse. Literally, you know, you've seen that. You wipe it off. You wipe it off your face. And you shake your hands. You wipe it off your legs. And that's what I would do. And then I'd walk in the front door and I'd be like, hey. Hola, what's up? And the kids would come running and I'd be like, what's up? Hey, mama. and oftentimes my husband might or might not be happy, you know, because he just got stuck with being with the kids for 3 or 4 days. Mm-hmm. So it was hard, you know. I mean, it was a real stress. You can't do that with a partner who's gonna give you shit all the time. And we didn't have the kind of salaries to be hiring full-time nanny kind of thing.
You talked about being on television feeling addictive, and it's a very competitive environment. You are, at that point, already a very experienced veteran journalist. Do you feel like, looking back, that your time with cable news distorted your values?
Well, that's exactly what my husband would say.
What would he say?
That's exactly. No. I mean, he was like, look, you understand what's going to happen? You're going to end up on The Tonight Show being made fun of because what CNN is asking you to do. And you are going to suffer the consequences of their ratings game. Mm-hmm. You are, you know, you need to be very careful because, and I think that, I think what actually set him off was, I mean, he could see it kind of coming. He was able to see, we could all see it. CNN was suddenly getting flashier. I mean, CNN basically was asking us to, in a ratings battle, to be more, in Spanish we say amarillista, in, you know, yellow journalism. Mm-hmm. You know, you may remember a CNN reporter getting tasered, mm-hmm, live on camera, and we were all just like, holy shit. And it's like, okay, great. And so now that's what's expected of us. Like, I'm going to have to get tasered in order to be taken seriously by the new president of CNN US. I have to, like, do you understand? Like, everything was getting warped.
Yeah.
And Germán fell in love with me because he saw the journalist in me. He saw the woman who was fighting for the First Amendment. So for Germán to say, you're teetering here, like it could happen any moment. And I knew it could. Yeah, it was hard. Huh. The problem is that, like, I was rejecting a part of my Mexican, Latina mother self because I didn't want to become my mother and subservient to my husband. But I was kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater, which was like, y'all can take care of yourselves. I'll see you later. I got to go do this because I got to build up my ego and I got to keep this job going and I got to keep on getting to yes and yes and yes.
What do you remember the moment you realized, oh, this marriage and family, this is not guaranteed to me. I might lose this.
It could have happened during those CNN moments, but I think I just maneuvered out of it really quickly. I was able to get another job. I left CNN. I was hired at now on PBS, and life changed in different ways. But the moment where that happened, and it was very clear, was it was 2016.
Oh.
And yeah, it was recent. And that was a moment where we almost separated. The marriage almost did not make it.
Coming up, the revelation that happened leading up to that crisis point, and how Maria had to take a hard look at herself and her priorities to preserve her marriage.
I did make a choice. My therapist said, you know, Maria, your children, they're going to see what this looks like. They're going to see what this choice looks like. And that's an incredible lesson because he loves you. This man loves you. And honestly, I got to be very honest with you. The idea of having sex with another person totally freaked me out.
Last week, I asked you to head over to our pandemic toolkit spreadsheet and give me some suggestions of what to do with the many, many cans of coconut milk currently taking up valuable space in my kitchen. You sent in recipes for a red lentil curry, a chocolate coconut pie, even whipped cream with coconut milk. Thank you, Carrie, Kulia, and Lori. But I gotta be honest, I have not brought myself to do anything special because I'm feeling so exhausted by the endless march of meal prep and dishes. And it's made us wonder what you're noticing about your relationship to food right now, 6 months into our much more homebound lives. How have your food routines changed? Who are you cooking for and eating with? How are you thinking about money and food right now? And I want to know what your most memorable meal of the last 6 months has been. Tell us about how food is working in your life right now. You can record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. And you can see our pandemic toolkit at deathsexmoney.org/pandemic toolkit. Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. In her new book, Maria Hinojosa writes frankly about desire and sex, and also about how, when she was 16 years old and on a date, she was raped. But it took her years before she could call it that.
I didn't call it a rape. It was not, I was definitely not even dealing with it or thinking about it. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, so I understand. I was always wary of streets and being alone and being a woman. And, you know, a rape is a man, you know, with a knife to your neck and in an alley. That's what it was. And I'm going to be honest with you. Here's what I used to call it. I was a baby rape.
Oh, you would say that? Why?
Can you imagine?
Why would you say that?
because I was like, wait, it wasn't a real rape. It was like a baby rape. And I get how horrible.
Why did baby rape feel like a more comfortable way to describe it than to just say rape? Why was that helpful?
Well, one, because I participated. I got in the car. I said yes. I saw him walking out to go buy rubbers, condoms, you know, and I didn't get out of the car. I didn't tell him when I realized he was an asshole. After all, I should have said, take me back home. I don't want to go. And I didn't. And I thought that because I did say no, that I always knew. I always said, no, 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 no. I said no the whole time. But maybe it was that kind of a no. So was it a screaming no? You know, so I guess that mean that it wasn't a real rape. I wasn't screaming no. The thing about rape and sexual assault with women is that we're convinced we made this happen. We were at fault. There was something wrong with us. Like, this is, you know, that's the trajectory. And of course, that is deeply ingrained. So it changed when my therapist, we were doing deep therapy on this. That was like 2015.
So you were in your 50s. You were in your 50s before you used the word rape for what happened to you as a teenager.
Oh, yeah. I was feeling really, I was admitting in the therapy, I was like, Iske, why did I do that? Why did I go with him? I mean, like, I understood, like, why did I do that? Like, I could tell he was an asshole. Like, sure, he was cute, but he was nothing special. Like, why? Mm-hmm. And then she said, Maria, you were a 16-year-old girl. You had every right to be hot and horny and want him, because that's what you feel when you're 16. And also, I thought I hadn't fought back. And now, of course, when you do therapy, that's what happens. You're like, oh shit, it's that he held me down. That's why I didn't fought back. That's why I hadn't been able to fight back. Once I was able to understand what was going on, it just really just comes all vomiting out. I just always was like, why am I? I said to my therapist, I remember. By now I had been seeing her for 10 years. I just, like, I don't even know how to start sex. Like, how? And she's like, oh, really? God, girl, I just walk into the kitchen and I start taking off my bra. And I'm just like, I could never. Thank God that my husband never gave up, honestly.
As Maria was processing all of this, she was also at a professional high point. After years of working for some of the country's biggest news organizations and winning numerous journalism awards along the way, she founded her own production company, Futuro Media Group, in 2010. But the demands of being an executive while still hosting and reporting intensified the pressures on her marriage.
I was busy working, and Herman would be like, sweetie, you're missing all kinds of stuff. And I'd be like, yeah. I just got this story to do. Okay, I just got to do this other thing. Okay, I'll be right back. I got to go do this. I got to go write this book. It was always, and that's the complaint, you know, is that it was always, there was always something else until they came to a breaking point. And then it was like, they're not going to be around. Like, they really are tired of you.
I want to make sure I understand. You say, you know, it sounds like you've had a few different points with your family and with your husband where you've realized you need to make adjustments. But you said the hardest moment was in 2016. What happened then?
What happened then was the thing that was always kind of hanging over me, that my best friend Sandy had told me, you need to be careful. You can't keep putting your husband at the bottom of the list of things that are important. You need to write that list of things that matter. Is he in the top? Is he number one, number two? You can't, you got to be careful. That moment arrived when he said, ¿sabes qué? I'm out. I think it was my ego. It was my bossing people around. It was my telling everybody what to do. You know, it was my inability to slow down and just, like, when you'll be with people. And actually, in his case, to just look at him give him time, respect. You know, I learned about the five love languages. You know, he needs time. I don't. You know, I need other things. Hermann wrote a 9-page letter by hand to my therapist so that my therapist could understand what was going on. Because he was like, I don't even want to, I'm done like doing the therapy thing. But he wrote this letter and he said, but you should read it. And I was so angry. I was so angry. I was like, you know, I was like, okay, you want to leave? We want to separate. Okay, fine. You know, as soon as the daughter goes off to school, you know, you'll move out or I'll move out. Blah, 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 blah. Anger, anger, anger. Blah, blah, blah. And then I was actually coming back from, I don't know what trip I was. And I read the letter and it was Hermann's heart. And suddenly I was able to see me from his perspective, like his narrative. It was very different than my narrative, which is what my therapist was saying. She's like, there are multiple narratives. You have to be able to, come on, you know this. You have a narrative, he has a narrative. And I was able to understand and then see his heart. And it broke my heart to see somebody who I loved feeling unloved. And so I just said, well, shit. No. I love you. I do. I love you. I love you. I love you. There are things that I can't stand about you, but I love you. And I'm going to forgive all of the things that have built up in a marriage that they do. And I'm letting them go. And I started to do deep meditation, woof, meditation all the time, forgiveness, letting go, the anger, letting go. And again, the therapy. And coming to terms, very clearly making choices about love. I am choosing, you know, and then I'd be with my therapist. But what about when he, and then he, and then he said, and then he, and she's like, Maria, what are you going to do? And of course, you know, one of the, when you start doing a little bit of meditation, it's like, well, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? You want to be right or you want to be happy? You want to keep on fighting that battle? Okay. Okay.
Do you still have that letter, Maria?
Oh, yes.
Where is it?
It's at the bottom of a drawer underneath some clothing that's in a kind of another little box. But I have thought I should probably put it someplace that's a little bit safer.
There's so much that you're saying that I'm relating to in marriage. And I think particularly for someone for whom work is really important and essential, to be in a marriage to a man when a man is telling you he wants you to do something differently, that can like rub up against the sort of like feminist reaction.
Oof.
I don't know about you. That's how I experience
it. You're exactly right. I was like, how? No, you can't. And the thing is that I guess what I'm trying to say is at a certain point, and it's very delicate, is that as women, we also have to be able to separate our position from our gender, and we just have to be able to hear it as a human being. Like, this is a human being saying this to another human being. You're seeing it as a man who's your husband, who's your partner, who's telling you what to do, as opposed to, is there a piece of advice that I really need to hear here? Is there something that he is seeing? And, you know, I'm a very good listener, but sometimes us listeners don't do so well when we have to listen to our families.
That's Maria Hinojosa. Her new book is called Once I Was You, a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. Her show, Latino USA, is a podcast and on public radio stations across the country. And she co-hosts a political podcast called In the Thick. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm usually based at the studios of the investigative podcast Reveal in Emeryville, California. Afi Yellowduke and Annabelle Bacon produced this episode. The rest of our team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Boteen, and Andrew Dunn. The Reverend John Delure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thanks to Shara Myers in Hunts Point, Washington, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Shara and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. Maria is working from her Manhattan home right now, along with her husband and two kids, who both recently moved back home. She says she's spending a lot of quality time with them, even though it's come with a different set of trade-offs.
It's not great for your sex life. But other than that...
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.